I'm going to begin this morning by just looking at a whole bunch of scriptures. This is not an exhaustive list. Wine is actually one of the most used words in all of scripture. It is all over scripture. We're just going to take a pretty small cross-section of a variety of passages throughout scripture that see wine in a very positive light. So let's just look at some of these. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Most High, Genesis 14:18. And then Genesis 27:28. May God give you the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine, Genesis 27:28. And with the first lamb, a tenth seah of fine flour, mingled with a fourth of a hin of beaten oil and a fourth of a hin of wine for a drink offering. So here the context is sacrificial offerings, and wine is part of it. And then Numbers 15:7, 5, 7, and 10. And you shall offer with the burnt offerings for the sacrifice a quarter of a hin of wine for the drink offering of each lamb. And for the drink offering you shall offer a third of a hin of wine, a pleasing aroma to the Lord. And you shall offer for the drink offering a half a hin of wine as a food offering, a pleasing aroma to the Lord. And then Leviticus 23:13. And the grain offering with it shall be two-tenths of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil, a food offering to the Lord with a pleasing aroma. And the drink offering with it shall be of wine, a fourth of a hin. And then Deuteronomy 7:13. He will love you, bless you, and multiply you. He will also bless the fruit of your womb and the fruit of your ground, your grain and your wine and your oil and the increase of your herds and the young of your flock in the land that he swore to your fathers to give you. And then Deuteronomy 14:26. And spend the money for whatever you desire, oxen or sheep or wine or strong drink, whatever your appetite craves, and you shall eat there before the Lord your God and rejoice, you and your household. And we'll come back to that verse a little later on and spend some more time in it. So Israel lived in safety. Jacob lived alone in the land of grain and wine, whose heavens dropped down dew, Deuteronomy 33:28. And then Deuteronomy 28:39 and 51. You shall plant vineyards and dress them, but you shall neither drink of the wine nor gather the grapes, for the worm shall eat them. It shall eat the offspring of your cattle and the fruit of your ground until you are destroyed. It shall not leave your grain, wine, or oil, or the increase of your herds, or the young of your flock until they have caused you to perish. Here's kind of a little bit of the other side of it. This is when God is pronouncing the curses on his people. One of the curses is they will plant vineyards, they'll make their wine, but they won't get to actually enjoy it. And that's one of the curses God lays on his people. All the best of the oil and all the best of the wine and of the grain, the first fruits of what they give the Lord, I give to you. The drink offerings shall be half a hin of wine for a bull, a third a hin for a ram, and a quarter of a hin for a lamb. This is the burnt offering of each month throughout the months of the year, Numbers 28:14. And then Judges 9:13. But the vine said to them, shall I leave my wine that cheers God and men and go hold sway over the trees? Judges 9:13. 2 Chronicles 31:5. As soon as the command was spread abroad, the people of Israel gave an abundance of the first fruits of grain, wine, oil, honey, and all the produce of the field, and they brought in abundantly the tithe of everything. In Psalm 104:15, and wine to gladden the heart of man, oil to make his face shine, and bread to strengthen man's heart. Proverbs 3:10, then your barn will be filled with plenty, and your vats will be bursting with wine. Proverbs 3:10. And Solomon 7:9, and your mouth like the best wine, it goes down smoothly for my beloved, gliding over lips and teeth. And then Isaiah 25:6. On this mountain the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine, of rich food full of marrow, of aged wine well refined. Isaiah 55:1. Come everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. He who has no money, come and buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without price. Isaiah 62:8. The Lord has sworn by his right hand and by his mighty arm, I will not again give your grain to be food for your enemies, and foreigners shall not drink your wine for which you have labored. And then Jeremiah 31:12. They shall come and sing aloud on the height of Zion, and they shall be radiant over the goodness of the Lord, over the grain, the wine, the oil, the young and the young of the flock and the herd. Their life shall be like a watered garden, and they shall languish no more. Joel 2:19 and 24, the Lord answered and said to his people, behold, I am sending to you grain, wine, and oil, and you will be satisfied, and I will no more make you a reproach among the nations. The threshing floors shall be full of grain, the vats shall overflow with wine and oil. And in that day the mountains shall drip sweet wine, and the hills shall flow with milk, and all the stream beds of Judah shall flow with water, and a fountain shall come forth from the house of the Lord and water the valley of Shittim. Joel 3:18. And then Micah 6:15. You shall sow but not reap. You shall tread olives but not anoint yourselves with oil. You shall tread grapes but not drink wine. Again, this is a picture of judgment. It's kind of the other side of it. When God curses his people, they not get to enjoy the wine that they have prepared. And then in the New Testament, 1 Timothy 5:23, no longer drink only water, but use a little wine for the sake of the stomach and your frequent ailments. Now, again, this is not every verse that mentions wine in Scripture, but the, kind of an overview of the different types of situations, mostly focused on either offerings or blessings. So, especially in the land of Israel, as the Lord is blessing his people, he says, if you do what is right, I will give you an abundance of wine. Your vats will overfill. One passage we didn't deal with here a little bit longer, but I think this is the point of the marriage supper of Cana, when Christ goes in and he turns the water into wine. Much has been made through the years of people trying to dismiss that as being wine, as when they'll start talking about how much it was. The fact that if they had consumed all that Christ made, everybody would have been just drunk beyond anything, any reality at that point, which is true, but that's part of the point. It's not that Christ gave that to them and said, go get drunk. It's that he fulfilled the pictures of the Old Testament, that he gave them above and beyond more than they could possibly use. Their vats overflowed. They had more than they could possibly use. It wasn't a, here, take this, go get drunk. It was the point that they couldn't use all that he gave them, fulfilling this picture of the Old Testament. The fact we see it used so frequently as part of the offerings to the Lord, they were to bring wine, and we'll think some more about that later on, but it was part of their offerings to the Lord. Again, if it is an evil substance, then you can't bring an evil substance to the Lord. If it's the leftover, if it's the bad, if it's the spoiled, then it's not a, if it's what you're going to be throwing out anyway, then it's not a good offering for the Lord. The Lord has to be brought the best, the pure, the things like that. And so the fact that we see it as an offering so often reminds us of its centrality. Now, there's some aspects of that that are unique to Israel. There is, in a sense, some of the pictures of the abundance of wine. Part of that is cultural, in that Israel is a wine country, and so part of if that's your primary crop is grape, or one of your primary crops, then having an abundance of wine is a blessing. Another culture may not have grapes as their primary fruit, and so therefore may not have wine, an abundance of wine as being the primary thing, but there may be some other issues that are. But wine is one of the most ubiquitous drinks around the world. Almost every culture has wine. Some cultures are more centered on it than others, but it is a international one. I think that's part of the reason that the Lord has established it the way he has it, especially as we'll think towards the end about its use in the Lord's Supper. So I kind of given that just to give this brief view and kind of get us thinking. When Scripture talks about wine, and it does frequently, it is frequently very, very positive. That does not mean that it's only positive. We could have also, somebody could maybe thinking, well, I could put up a whole list of all the places where it's spoken of negatively. And there are quite a few of those too, but that's where we have to kind of wrestle through and see why Scripture teaches about it the way they do. Now, for most of the history of the church, this has not been a controversial issue. There'll be little groups, individuals like Timothy, that for whatever reason, for a period of time, decide not to drink. And we'll think later on about the fact that even in Israel, there was different groups that forsook wine. You have the Nazarites who didn't drink wine. You have the Rechabites that didn't drink wine. Timothy didn't drink wine. But those are all seen as unusual and abnormal and not a call upon the Christians, the followers of God in general, but people that were making decisions for a particular reason. In Timothy's case, Paul, actually, as we read a moment ago, comes to him and says, go ahead and drink a little wine for your stomach's sake. You're having problems, and the answer to your problems is wine. Don't continue being in total abstinence. But in spite of the fact that for most of the church's history, this has not been a controversial issue, for the past 150 years or so, maybe a little bit longer, it has become a very controversial issue, resulting in around 100 years ago or so, kind of the pinnacle of, we reached a point to where almost the entirety of evangelical Christianity condemned alcohol, to the point that in our nation, we actually, in the United States, in the 1930s, they finally passed prohibition, and it was illegal to drink alcohol or manufacture, just illegal to manufacture alcohol primarily. And for several years, alcohol was illegal in this country. Of course, it didn't stop the problems of drunkenness, and it didn't stop the problems of all the problems that went with it. And within a very brief period of time, those laws were being repealed. But the question we need to think about, I want to think about first this morning, is why, in light of the fact that Scripture is so positive on it in so many different places, why could we get there? And I think this is important, as I mentioned a moment ago, because we condemn Rome for them condemning marriage or condemning sexual relations in general. But we've really done the same thing. I mean, we could go through and have a similar thought process on marriage and sexual relations. We can go through and we can list all the places in Scripture where sexual relations are mentioned, and we can think about all the places where it's positive, and then we can go look at all the places where it's negative. And do the same sort of thing. And the point is the reminder that scope of Scripture is understanding why there's the differing views based upon the different situations. But in light of that, 150 years ago or so, there begin to be various groups that begin to teach against it. Now, one of the things that I think is informative in this is the abolitionist movement initially was not a Christian movement. And I think that's important for us to recognize. The abolitionist movement was primarily initially a secular endeavor. There was a group, there was various people involved in it, but they had a humanistic tendency towards utopias. And there was a variety of issues that they believed were stopping us from living the best life now, so to speak, only in a very secular way. One of the most classic examples of this is Walden's Pond by Henry David Thoreau, although I don't know if he'd deal with alcohol as much on that. But he's one of that type of mentality of this utopian society, if we can just bring this in. And alcohol began to be a very big part of that. There began to be a movement that people beginning to decide more and more that alcohol was one of the main reasons, one of the main things keeping us from living in utopia right now. If we could just ban alcohol and a couple of things. One of the things they also wanted to ban was good. They were trying to ban slavery as well. And so some of it was good, some of it was bad. But the idea that if we can just get rid of these things, we'll have utopia. Of course, they got rid of slavery, and about 60 years later, they got rid of alcohol. And instead of finding utopia, what did we find? Rise in crime and all kinds of problems, because we're not going to bring in utopia through our man-made efforts. It's only going to come through the gospel. But this began to be the push. And there began to be a lot of arguments put forward as people begin to look at the devastating effects of drunkenness on society. And so A lot of really bad things are going on. Especially the late 19th century is really a low point in our country for drunkenness. The late 19th century saw, part of it was because of the war, the Civil War. A lot of men coming back from that decided that the best way to get rid of the memories of the horrors of the war were to drink themselves into oblivion. And just think about what we know about what happens when people spend all their time getting drunk. You end up with a lot of domestic abuse because they're drunk. They come home, start beating their kids, beating their wives, all kinds of problems happening. And so there began to be more and more the push for temperance in the late 19th century. And, of course, temperance is the idea of self-control, it's anti-drunkenness. But eventually that became not just anti-drunkenness, it became anti-alcohol. Now, on the one hand, the things they're upset about, the abuse of alcohol, we should be upset about. We should be upset, and we should be strongly opposed to the abuse of alcohol and all of the sins that so often frequent the abuse of alcohol. Those are horrible things, and they should be condemned. But it's the same again. The same thing goes true with sexual relations as well. We should be horrified by the abuse of sexual relations, and should condemn it strongly. But we don't swing the pendulum to the other extreme and say, "Well, then the problem is not the abuse of the gift. The problem is the gift itself." That's what Rome did with marriage and sex, and that's what we, evangelicalism, has done with alcohol. Instead of recognizing this distinction between the good gift and the abuse of the good gift, we end up trying to throw out everything together. Now, the problem that you're faced with is, if you're going to take this view, how do you wrestle with the biblical record? What's interesting is some of the earliest writings that I've seen on it in the mid to early 19th century, they really didn't even try to wrestle with the biblical record. There just began to be more of a modern science has shown us this, and we know better now. Albert Barnes, in his commentary on John 2, basically tries, on the one hand, downplay how alcoholic the wine was, but then kind of finishes off with, yeah, Christ gave all the people all that wine, but we know better today. We wouldn't do that. Christ, if he was living today, wouldn't do that because we know how bad alcohol is. Which is a very, very low view of inspiration of you're really calling Christ a sinner, even though you're trying to soften it and make it about his culture. You know, he didn't really know what he was doing, but it really begins to create a lot of problems and a lot of weakness. But within a very short period of time, and Barnes is one of the leaders in this movement, they're beginning to develop what was called the two wine theory. And basically, the two wine theory is, if we look at Scripture, every time it says wine, if it's positive, it's talking about grape juice, and if it's negative, it's talking about wine. And I'm serious, that really is, if you talk to people that hold to the two wine theory, that is how they tell you to determine it. Now, what they believe is that the word oinos, or the Hebrew word for wine, the two main words, are generic. That they're, and to a degree they are, but they believe they're generic in the sense that they include both wine and grape juice. Now, they're generic for historians, etymologists, and things like that, in the sense, like, our word wine is generic. When we say wine, we're talking about a fermented beverage generally made from grapes. But it can mean a variety of things. But we don't say wine when we're talking about grape juice. That's a different beverage. You know, wine can mean white wines and red wines and rosés, and then within the white wines, we could break them down into a variety of categories. But we could also think about strawberry wine or some other type of wine along that line as well. So wine is generic, but it's still always referring to an alcoholic beverage. But they tried to argue that these Greek and Hebrew words were broader in the sense that they included a variety of non-alcoholic beverages. And so then the way to figure that out is it talking about it positively? If it's talking about it positively, then it has to be grape juice. If they're talking about it negatively, then it has to be wine. And then there's also those that argue not quite as extreme as the two wine theory, but those that argue that alcohol may not be condemned in Scripture, but we shouldn't use it. So it's kind of what I talked about with Barnes a moment ago. Well, maybe Scripture doesn't condemn it. Maybe it's not seen as evil in Scripture, but it still shouldn't be used. We still shouldn't do it. Why? Because it's just bad. You know, look at all the problems. Look at all the things. And that really is where actually Rome is with marriage for the priesthood. And this, I think, is one of the misnomers that we often have. We often believe that Rome believes that it is a sin for a priest to marry. How many of you are aware that there are actually married priests right now in the Catholic world? There are some. Most of them are ones that convert to Catholicism, Roman Catholicism, from Eastern Orthodoxy. But there's an entire sect of priests that have wives. Now, generally, if you come up within Rome and become a priest, you never marry. But if you have a wife before you become a priest, you're allowed to keep that wife. Because they don't believe that it's actually sinful. They just believe that sexual relations are not good, and it's better to abstain. So this is very similar to one of the more common arguments against alcohol. It's good, but it's not forbidden, but it's better to abstain. That becomes a very common view. With this, there is an argument that says that in the past, that wine had a lower alcohol content. So this is another view that you'll see occasionally, basically trying to condemn modern use of wine while justifying biblical use of wine, trying to argue that in biblical times they had wine, but it was a much lower wine alcohol content. We'll talk about that more later on. Another issue is just it's unwise to drink with rampant drunkenness in the world. And we see that, but that's not anything new. This has been around. Scripture dealt with this. We're going to look at some writings from a Roman historian that dealing with the same thing just prior to the time of Christ. This has always been the case. It always will be the case. And again, the answer is not to try to add to God's rules, but to try to emphasize the right views. Another view, and this one appeals to a lot of people. Why take the chance on drunkenness? If there's a chance of having problems, why take the chance? But again, that's really the same view that Rome takes with sex. If you know, why take the chance on having a wrong sexual idea? Why not just ban it? Let's just get rid of it, and then we don't have to worry about having problems. But here's the problem with that. Let me ask this question. What are some of the problems with that view? Just thinking back over what we've thought about through Christian liberty so far. It applies to everything. That's right off the bat, that's a big one. What else? What about the fact that it doesn't deal with the heart? That really is a fence, isn't it? It's what we've talked about with fences. We've put up a fence. Well, if I put up this fence, then I won't sin. But you know, let's think again. Let's go with sexual relations. We can put up a fence like the Billy Graham rule so that we're never around a woman, so we can never commit adultery physically. But does that solve the problem of adultery in the heart? You know, it actually hasn't dealt with the real issue. If my heart is adulterous, I can put up all the fences I want. I still haven't stopped sin. And that's part of Christ's point in Matthew 5 that we'll look at in a few weeks. And that's part of the problem here. We really haven't solved anything. If our mindset is intemperate and sinful, we really haven't accomplished anything. Now, I will say that this is a valid point, like we have with other things, insofar as individually, if I have a particular struggle, there's always the idea that at least for a time it may be good for me to be careful, to put up some fences, so to speak, individually to help me get control, to not feed the temptation, to not make provision for the flesh. But that's individual and generally should be, for the most part, temporary, while the heart is being addressed, not universal, then applied to every single person in all situations. Okay, I'm going to pause there for a moment, and I'm going to look at one historical example of development on this, and then we'll get into the more positive argument. But are there any questions or comments about some of the arguments against the use of alcohol this morning before we get to that? Yes, Wayne. Yeah, and that's not a very good reason, is it? And again, that's the other side of it. You know, when that's our mentality, that desire is sinful, and so therefore, when we are drinking to fulfill a sinful desire, we're sinful before we even start drinking, and then again, if you're going to make the world go away, you're going to have to drink a whole lot, and so then we give all kinds of problems, and that's. Again, that's part of the issue, but that comes back why we have to really think about the heart. Why am I doing what I'm doing?
Well, if you drink it long enough and hard enough, it will actually kill you.
Yep. And we'll think about that more in a moment as well. Yes.
So when did the church start going to grape juice?
We're going to talk about that in my next point. Yeah, yeah. I will answer that here in just a second. Yes, Mr. Welch. Yeah. That actually, I said I was going to deal with a historical issue. That's the historical issue. Okay. If no more questions, let's go ahead and address that. Let's address that topic. When I was doing some work on this in seminary, I traced through the first denomination to really go down this path was the Methodists. They were the first ones to really go down this. And they started, in a sense, speaking against alcohol back in from almost the very beginning. Their teachers and leaders began to condemn alcohol to some degree almost from the beginning of Methodism. And they were very, very unique in that. But even then, as we'll see, they were very measured in how they did it, kind of more of the, well, Scripture doesn't condemn it, but we know better type arguments. So in the Doctrines and Disciplines of the Methodist Episcopal Church, from 1798, we read this. Here, St. Paul, this is talking about the late Christians in Corinthians, so Corinthians chapter 11 is Paul's giving his condemnation of how those Corinthians are participating. Here, St. Paul does not condemn there, at the late Corinthians, drinking the wine at the Lord's Supper, which he certainly would have if the cup was confined to the ministers, but if they're both eating and drinking most intemperately. Now, the context. What they are addressing here is the issue that Rome had gotten into the practice of only the priesthood actually taking the cup. So they would give the bread to the host, to the congregants, but only the priests would take the cup. That's still, I think, a little common today. I think it depends upon where you're at. Scott, I think you've mentioned before that you've seen that, right? Maybe not. Okay. 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 Yeah. Okay. So this has been an issue within Rome at different times, of this denial of the cup to the people. I know it was a big issue back at the time of the Reformation. I think it's kind of come and gone is how it's been handled. But that's what they're addressing, and they're condemning that practice. But note that they are acknowledging that they're making the point that that they're eating and drinking intemperately, and so much they're getting drunk in their doing of that. Now, later on in the same thing, they address this issue, and they declare that wine is to be taken only medicinally or sacramentally by the priests, or not the priests, the pastors, the Methodist pastors, and they are to only and basically there's begin to be an encouragement that the laity should do the same thing. Now, this is important because in 1798 they are dismissing alcohol in general, but they are still providing for its use in particular circumstances. So at that time, it's still very common for wine to be used for medicine in a variety of ways, and then of course, sacramentally meaning the Lord's Supper. So if you're doing it for that, go ahead and take wine, but otherwise, don't. Now, the reason I think this is important is because they're the first ones even to be making this argument, and this is the end of this 18th century. But they're still defending the use of wine, recognizing when Scripture talks about wine, it's talking about wine and not grape juice. Now, let's flash forward just under 70 years, 64 years, and not 64, 66 years, and all of a sudden, the very same thing, doctrines and disciplines in the Methodist Episcopal Church, which comes out every few years, they've now completely changed their view. They make a new resolution, now condemning alcohol outright. Resolved that this general conference recommend each pastor to preach specifically upon the subject, to point out the danger of social and more public and common forms of intemperance, and to urge total abstinence from all that can intoxicate. And then resolved that we earnestly recommend that in all cases the pure juice of the grape be used in the celebration of the Lord's Supper. So now there's a shift. 60 plus years earlier, they were saying, go ahead and we want to dismiss people drinking alcohol, but you have to do it for the Lord's Supper. You have to do it medicinally, so it's okay in that regard. Just over 60 years later, now they're saying, now we want everybody to start preaching against it, and we really want to get people to stop. We recognize we may not get everybody to stop, but let's start pushing and encouraging that direction. And then finally, let's stop using it for the Lord's Supper. Now, there's a reason for this, and Dwight's already given the answer to that, but that is Mr. Welch. Mr. Welch, does anybody know what denomination he was? Methodist, yeah. And so right in the middle of this, Welch was a Methodist, just a Methodist layman. He wasn't a preacher. But the church had already begun to emphasize, and more the Methodist church was teaching more and more against alcohol. And the general consensus amongst so many of the Methodist laity or Methodist churches was that alcohol was wrong, and there began to be a sense of, man, it's really tough. We don't believe alcohol is a good thing to do. Wine shouldn't be drunk, but we're drinking it every week for however often they were taking the Lord's Supper. We're partaking of it for the Lord's Supper. And so does anybody else know anything else that happened around that time that might have been important to this? Not refrigeration. Pasteurization. So pasteurization, primarily initially done for milk, but Welch began to wonder, hey, I wonder if I can take that same process and use it for grape juice. And he did. He was successful. Started that, and actually, the Welch's grape. He actually cultivated his own type of grape, which is a little bit larger than normal grapes. It has less yeast on it, and which is an important thing we'll think about later, probably next week. And then they started pasteurizing the juice, which in effect killed all of the yeast in it, preventing it from going ahead and fermenting and becoming wine. And so really invented a whole new product that up until that point had been unknown. Until Welch, the idea of drinking unfermented grape juice was just, nobody in the history of the world really had a concept of that. In light of the Methodist movement, you have the secular world, let's have utopia without wine, the Methodists kind of pushing this thing, and then Welch invents grape juice. And all of a sudden, there's a domino effect. And over the next 60 years or so, we go from having this be a fringe movement of a few Methodists to becoming the predominant view of at least American evangelicalism, but also spreading around the world from here as well. I'm going to give a quick overview of just the two wine theory. I've already kind of given this, but... The position is that when wine is mentioned in a good way, it is non-alcoholic. When it's mentioned in a bad way, it is alcoholic. David Wilkerson, in his book Sipping Saints, which is his condemnation of anybody that claims to be a Christian and drinks. As far as I am concerned, Scripture and historical facts prove that there were two kinds of wine. One was intoxicating and one was not. Albert Barnes, in his notes on John 2, says Pliny expressly says that good wine was one that was destitute of spirits. It should not be assumed, therefore, that good wine was stronger than the other. It is rather to be presumed that it was milder. The wine referred to here was doubtless such as was commonly drunk in Palestine, and that was the pure juice of the grape. And then Peter Lumpkins, in his book, and I just went too fast. Peter Lumpkins, in his book, Alcohol Today, in Scripture, what we have is a variety of wines. Of the hundreds of references in the Old Testament, just more than half refer to unfermented, non-intoxicating wine products. Now, how does he come up with that number? Because just over half of them are used in a positive sense. So, therefore, they must be non-intoxicating, non-fermenting. Where are we at for time? Let me try to get through this real quick. What are the problems with this view? Well, the quotes are seriously misquoted. This is from a book written in the 19th century, kind of part of the pushback as people begin to study the issue. Because you have this overwhelming just surge. You know, you have that statement by Barnes. You know, Pliny the Elder says that the best wine is the one destitute of spirits. And you begin to have these kind of quotes. If you read out Barnes and others, you'll see these quotes. And, of course, what's interesting to me is I've gone through and I've read most of these writers in that era. They're all using the same two or three quotes, and they use it over and over again. And you flash forward to our modern society, and even those that continue to push this view keep going back to the same two or three quotes. And the problem is, even those same two or three quotes aren't actually accurate. And this is what they begin to realize there by the end of the 19th century. Edward Jewett notes, careful examination by scholars have resulted in revealing the utter baselessness and worthlessness of the arguments and authorities brought forward in support of the generic theory. And this is the case all around the circle. The leading scholars of all denominations unite in rejecting it. In marked instances, quotations from classic authors, which have been held up triumphantly as evidence in its favor, are found upon honest examination to give most reliable help in confuting it. Pliny is one of the great examples of this. We just read Barnes's use of Pliny. The best wine is the one destitute in spirits. That quote is not in Pliny. I have read Pliny's. Pliny the Elder's Natural Histories. It's a very, very significant book on this topic, not so much in the from a biblical view of wine, but just in the it's Pliny tried to make an encyclopedia of natural things, so grain and you name it. But he has an entire section on wine, and as he goes through it, I've read the entire section on wine. I haven't found that quote yet, and I've read it multiple times. I cannot find it. The only time that he addresses anything in that entire section that is non-alcoholic, he actually makes the point that it can't be called wine because it's non-alcoholic. This is from his section 14.7. It is the property of wine when drunk to cause a feeling of warmth in the interior of the viscera, and when poured upon the exterior of the body to be cool and refreshing. We may feel ourselves quite justified in saying that there is nothing more useful than wine for strengthening the body, while at the same time there is nothing more pernicious as a luxury if we are not on our guard against excesses. That's how he begins the section on wine, describing it in very intoxicating language, but also noting the difference how, and he goes on to really expand on this, about how if we, when done in moderation, it's a wonderful blessing. When done in excess, it is a curse. It's a blight upon society. He also goes on, and later on, I said mentioned that he mentions the non-alcoholic beverage. The only non-alcoholic beverage he has in this is a beverage made not from the grape, but from grape leaves. So there was some kind of beverage to take the grape leaves, probably close to what we would call tea today. They would press these grape leaves into water and make a beverage out of that. And he is at the end of his section on wine, and he says, basically, this cannot actually properly be called wine because it's not fermented from the grape. And that's the only time he talks about anything non-alcoholic. And in fact, he begins the entire section talking about the alcoholic nature of the wine. Now, why is this significant? Well, this is the main source that has been put forward to prove the two-wine theory, and it doesn't even exist in the book. And in fact, Pliny says the exact opposite, which is what Jewett and others note. And there's a few other quotes that are put forward. I haven't had the time to explore the others as much, although from what I know about them, they're as flawed as the Pliny quote. But this really does make a problem as we stop and think about it. This shows, you know, most people that have continued this thing, they haven't actually gone back and looked at the sources. They just keep quoting Barnes. And in fact, you'll see an awful lot of the people, the more modern writers, just quote Barnes. They just go back. They'll, you know, Pliny as quoted in Barnes. And nobody bothers to go back and read Pliny and realize Pliny doesn't say that. Now, I don't know where Barnes got the idea from, what he read, if he read somebody else who invented it, where it came from. I don't think anybody has established that, but the ancients don't actually support the view, and so it creates a problem. I'm going to go ahead and pause there. Next week we'll get into some of the other problems with the theory and why the view just doesn't fit even with the scriptural record, that it just can't reconcile this whole idea of if it's being used positively, it's grape juice, and if it's being used negatively, it's wine, because Scripture speaks too frequently of the positive, the positiveness of inebriation, at least in a limited sense, and we're intoxicating beverages. So, but let's pause there today. We've only got a couple minutes left. Are there any questions or comments before we close today? Yes. I don't believe so. And we'll talk about that a little bit more next week. The winemaking process, just to kind of set the stage for that, wine really doesn't fluctuate in alcohol content. The way that wine is made, grape is very unique in that it has everything that it needs to make wine within the grape. Almost everything else you have to add ingredients. Wine has everything it needs within the grape. It has both the yeast and the sugar to make the wine. And what happens when wine is being made, when grape wine is being made, the sugar ferments, the sugar and the yeast get together, ferment, turn into alcohol. And when the alcohol reaches about 16.4%, something like that, it kills off the rest of the yeast and it stops. And you really don't stop it before that, and it doesn't go higher than that. The way we have fortified wines, you know, stronger alcohol like port and things like that, to get that you actually have to add more sugar. And so it's a very intentional process to increase the alcohol level. But to keep it where it is, to get it lower is almost impossible without really making some changes. And in fact, if you do, then it becomes a very unstable drink that doesn't last, it doesn't keep. And so wine is very, 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 very stable. Now, the other view that's often used is the idea of diluting wine with water. And there's a variety of issues with that. One, Dwight was just pointing to the day, that it's interesting that the record seems to show that was one of the big things with Israel, is they didn't dilute when some other nations around them did, especially in worship, because, you know, they would dilute it with the idea, I'm going to, you know, bring this diluted version so I don't have to give all my wine. But that's the point of Scripture, is give the best, not the diluted. Secondly, as one of my friends likes to point out, if it's diluted, and that's the normal thing to drink, how are we getting drunk? You know, all the warnings about drunkenness in the New Testament. If it's diluted down in low alcohol, how are we getting drunk? Especially as some will argue that it's diluted, you know, a couple hundred times, something like that. And it's like, well, then now we're talking almost minuscule alcohol. You're drinking gallons to be able to get drunk. And so it kind of makes some of those warnings just don't make sense. So we'll explore that a little bit more next week, but no, I don't think there is, and that issue kind of shows up the problem. The reason I'm going ahead and dealing with this, it shows how we have a tendency to read what we want to read in the Scripture. I'm going to talk about cultural eisegesis next week. We've already mentioned a little bit. We'll talk about some more in this. How the way we take what we want things to be and try to read that back into Scripture rather than letting Scripture and the evidence speak for itself. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 No, no. Yeah. 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 And the thing is, there's things like that, and I think that are again, is, and we'll think about this more next week as we get into some other aspects of this. Again, the point is not, with all of Christian liberty, is not this is, you know, you have to do this because Scripture permits it. And again, taste is an issue. There's, you know, there's people that don't, you know, Christ or Paul goes through all the different reasons why people are eunuchs. Some are, they're made to be eunuchs, and other people are eunuchs by choice just because that's their desires in life. And I think the same thing, some people are teetotalers, as we might say, with alcohol because they just don't like alcohol. And that is perfectly fine. Yeah, yeah. 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 No, there's a lot of reasons, there's a lot of good reasons why an individual may not drink. And the point is not that we must drink. The point is, the main reason for this is to wrestle through, I think that there's a variety of reasons why we're dealing with the topic, and we'll summarize this more a little bit next week, but to think through the ways in which we commonly mishandle Scripture. We commonly bind consciences based upon our own weakness. But also thinking through, in at least for the Lord's Supper, why it is positive to go forward in a positive light with wine rather than grape juice. But we'll deal with some more of that next week. We do need to wrap things up. Are there anything real quickly before we close up? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, one day, it's already starting to smell funny. Mm-hmm. So if you have grape sugar, you can drink it right away, and it's very sweet. I mean, sweeter than anything you've ever had. So then you let it sit there for a little while, and it's smelling funny and bubbling, and you're like, oh, boy.
Yeah.
And don't touch it.
Yeah.
It's really terrible. Two, it's interesting that Methodists who are Armenian, who are synergistic, have got a man better. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I like that. I could use that as I put about grapes and man's ingenuity, and now we have grape juice.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have to have the wine.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's interesting. These are very
synergistic. Yeah.
Too.
Yeah.
So I think it's a really cool example of that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that aspect of it before, but yeah, it is. And we'll talk about this more next week, but grapes is the most unique. It's fascinating in this picture. Because grapes are one of the most ubiquitous fruits around the world. It's one of the few fruits that we find almost everywhere. And it's the only fruit, there's one other one that comes close, but it's just about the only fruit that contains everything to make wine within itself. Everything else you have to add yeast or add sugar or different things like that. The grape is very unique in what it does. But we'll think about that more. We're going to actually look at the process of winemaking briefly next week and think through some of that. So let's go ahead and close.